This is an episode about consulting, specifically addressing some challenges involved with the current consulting model and possibly some ways it could improve. It also covers some difficulties that may arise when mentoring a consultant in training or being mentored as a consultant in training. You're listening to Working for the Word. I'm Andrew Case. Let's get started. Recently, I supervised a consultant in training doing practice checking, and I want to share some lessons learned from that experience. We were looking at 2 Chronicles chapter 6, and first, I gave the trainee an introduction to the translation philosophy and process that we follow on the team. I provided an overview of the cultural and linguistic issues we've encountered so far with the team, decisions made about key terms, the team's education level, and the tools they're using. This particular trainee is really good at picking out details, which is an essential skill for any consultant, as I've said in the past. However, one learning point is that if you're coming into an ongoing project and are zealous about picking out small details, my recommendation would be to err on the side of doing less nitpicking. It's a difficult balance to strike between ensuring the translation accurately conveys God's word while also not slowing down or annoying the team excessively with perfectionism that may be misguided. Of course, there are no perfect translations, but you want it to be as good as possible without causing unnecessary friction in the process. What I've noticed is that some people have a low tolerance for meaning-based translations. If the back translation doesn't represent a very literal way that the Hebrew or Greek expresses something, they want to write a note questioning it, but that's generally not helpful. An extremely important aspect of being a consultant is having mental flexibility to understand that there will be many ways languages must adjust and reorient the text to work in their language. This linguistic flexibility is essential, but not always easy. Back translations should represent fairly literally how the translation renders the meaning in that language, and there will often be cognitive dissonance between the back translation and the source texts you're consulting from. So you have to work through the dissonance to see how the back translation aims to communicate the original meaning, even if it doesn't immediately or obviously seem to map onto the source text. It often just takes more work to see the adjustments made to convey the meaning. Now here's an example, a simple example. If you're reading the back translation of 2 Chronicles 6:2, and it says, "a place for you to live forever," instead of "a place for you to dwell forever," that's not a great place to write a note questioning if the same word is used for dwell and live. It should be obvious, and since this team has years of experience, you should trust they know what they're doing in their language at that point. Another example is 2 Chronicles 6:14, which says, "If your people Israel are defeated before the enemy because they have sinned against you, and they turn again and acknowledge your name and pray and plead with you in this house," We notice that it's a conditional clause in the ESV, "if your people Israel are defeated," etc. A conditional clause, but say you're reading the back translation and it begins the clause with the word "when." You may think it's a serious difference, but some languages can communicate conditional clauses as temporal clauses, like "when this happens, do this," to convey the same meaning as "if this happens, do this." Also, it's important before writing a note to check if major source text versions also use "when" instead of "if" in that instance. And in this case, the NIV Spanish translation and Dios Habla Hoy use "cuando" here, "when." So there's no need to flag that difference. They did that. They felt it was appropriate to use "when" in this clause. And so there's no need to flag that with the team. You'll also need tolerance for redundancy reduction. Many languages must reduce redundancy from Hebrew to sound natural, removing unnecessary repetition while still conveying the meaning. For example, in 2 Chronicles 6:25, the ESV has, "forgive the sin of your people Israel and bring them again to the land." But the previous verse already mentioned their sin. So in the back translation, the Chatino team reduced it to just forgive them instead of forgive the sin of your people to avoid redundancy, since the full idea was already activated for the reader in the previous verse, including the elements of your people Israel. Redundancy elimination is often necessary to make it sound natural or palatable in the language, once again. So there's no reason to write a note questioning the redundancy reduction in that verse, since nothing important is lost by eliminating the repeated elements. These are the kinds of things consultants must be flexible with. Nitpicking such issues will only slow down the team and annoy them by forcing unnecessary explanations when no meaning is truly lost. While repetition may stylistically sound better to a Hebrew speaker, it doesn't in this language. So in summary so far, nitpicking small semantic differences, questioning legitimate ways of conveying meaning cross-linguistically, and requiring redundancy that's unnecessary in the target language, these things can be unhelpful for a consultant to do. You have to exercise flexibility on these issues. Another example requiring this flexibility is 2 Chronicles 6:29. It says, "Whatever prayer, whatever plea is made by any man or by all your people Israel, each knowing his own affliction and sorrow and stretching out his hands toward this house, ... So in Spanish, these verbs would be rendered in the subjunctive mood as hypothetical. So we get that subjunctive idea when it starts in the verse in English with whatever prayer, whatever plea. So in Spanish, these verbs would be rendered in the subjunctive mood. These verbs like each knowing his own affliction, stretching out his hands toward this house, etc. But in the back translation, you may see that the team used future tense verbs instead of subjunctive. And the ESV doesn't even use subjunctive verbs here in English, right? This is because the language expresses subjunctive meanings similarly to how English uses the future tense, the language this team is translating into, that is. So it works similarly to how English uses future tense sometimes to communicate subjunctive. In modern English, we will often use future will constructions. He will do this instead of the subjunctive to convey contingencies, recommendations, or hypotheticals. So seeing future instead of subjunctive in the back translation does not necessarily need to be flagged because it's just the language's way of conveying that type of meaning. You need flexibility to allow for these cross-linguistic adjustments. Another redundancy reduction example is in 2 Chronicles 6:32-33. Which mentions the foreigner twice. But in this team's back translation, it's not repeated in the second verse. So this valid reduction doesn't need to be questioned unless it's the first time you're seeing it for the team, in which case you could ask them to make sure they didn't simply blindly follow a version like the NIV that reduced it without consciously reducing it to sound more natural in their own language. Because that sometimes happens. You know, the team will be following a version blindly and not looking at what the actual Hebrew has or a more literal version to see, okay, has there been redundancy reduction that doesn't necessarily need to happen in our language? And maybe it will sound better in our language if we don't do what the NIV did. So you just need to check that if you're new with the team. In general, you can check if other solid translations also reduce such redundancies. Questioning these types of natural linguistic adjustments over and over can often slow the progress of the team unnecessarily when the meaning is properly conveyed. Now, one suggestion for the consultant in training is to provide more thorough explanations for their notes. Now, in this particular situation where I'm a mentor, one suggestion that I've had for this consultant in training is to provide more thorough explanations for their notes. Instead of just asking, why did you choose this word? Asking the team that, right? What does this word mean? A better note would give more context. Like, I'd like to hear more about the decision to use this word to translate the act of justifying or absolving or declaring just. I suggest looking at 2 Corinthians 5:21, 1 Corinthians 1:30, Romans 10:5, to see how they treated this idea of justice or justification in the past, the translators of the New Testament in that language. How did they treat those concepts since they already have a New Testament translated? Now, changing topics, but staying under the umbrella of consulting, I asked a consultant in training to do some research on the statistics of my notes written over the past couple years for this same team. The goal was to understand what percentage of notes caught advanced issues requiring expertise versus simple mistakes the team could have caught themselves with a little more diligence. Now, this is especially relevant since a couple team members had prior Hebrew training and they used the United Bible Society translation handbooks, which are like having a built-in consultant. And for the most part, they carefully follow those manuals, which makes my job much easier. So the research found that around 20% of notes, of my notes, were on advanced issues, while around 80% were simple mistakes they could have caught themselves. It looked something up, caught it with more reviews of their draft, or just back translation errors when their actual translation was correct in the end. Now, to evaluate whether a note really is advanced and whether the team could have figured it out on their own or not is admittedly very subjective, highly subjective. And it really requires an intimate knowledge of the team, right? You have to know what their capabilities are, what kind of tools they have access to, all of those sorts of things, know their experience, etc. And so what I have found evaluating what this consultant in training did with these statistics is that the percentage of advanced notes, what I consider advanced notes, is actually much smaller than 20%. So far in my evaluation going through some of these, it might be closer to 10% or less. So that means 10% or less of what I'm doing at this point with the team, after having trained them in Hebrew, after giving them access to these United Bible Society handbooks, really my job is not coming across as extremely crucial at this point. So one simple note was in Genesis 1:11, explaining that the Hebrew distinguishes between seed-bearing plants and fruit-bearing trees, based on how they produce seeds. But then in the note, I asked how Chatino classifies the different plants, since that classification may differ. And this note was labeled as simple, since it's just asking for clarification based on my lack of Chatino cultural / linguistic knowledge. And it should be observed that many of my notes don't lead to changes in the text. And then if they do, they may not be significant changes. Another simple note was in Genesis 1:21, where it mentions God creating the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves. In Hebrew, it just says every living soul or being. Since the team had it as animals in the back translation, I asked if there is a more general category in their language for living beings, like the Hebrew term meaning beings that breathe. So there were many other simple notes just asking if something was an error in the back translation that they confirmed and corrected when their actual translation was fine. As for more advanced notes requiring expertise, here's one, and it may or may not be. In Genesis 1:14 about the lights in the heavens being for seasons, the note explained that a better translation than seasons would be something like fixed times or designated times, as the Hebrew refers more to periods for human activities like agriculture or festivals, not just the seasons of the year. The Os Hablaoi had translated it best as special dates. Another example of a more subjective advanced note was on Genesis 3:24 regarding the translation of cherubim. The team had rendered it as angels that were pure fire. And the consultant's note gave some background that cherubim are described in the Old Testament as God-bearers and guardians of holy things, giving examples like riding with God in the storm, Psalm 18:10, guarding the ark, 1 Kings 6:23, being living creatures with wings, lion, bull bodies, Ezekiel 1:5 through 12, and carrying out God's commands along with angels. But the Bible doesn't mention them being made of fire. So these more advanced notes, you might say, required providing deeper contextual and linguistic insights that the team may have missed or needed expertise to properly understand and translate certain concepts accurately. But again, I want to highlight, where did I get a lot of this information? Did I just pull it out of my own brain that was just sitting there on tap, that I have this encyclopedic knowledge of these different things in Hebrew and in Scripture? Not at all. And I don't think most consultants are doing that. Most consultants simply are using the tools at their disposal. So they have Logos opened, they have BibleWorks opened, they have different commentaries or whatever, and they're sifting through those to find the right answers to things. The difference between them at the end of the day and a well-trained mother tongue translator who is working in Spanish or working in another trade language, the difference just comes down to access to resources. That's it. So a consultant that speaks English has got it all. And a translator that doesn't just has to rely on that consultant for a lot of these higher level issues. I don't want to oversimplify the case here or overstate the case, but I want to make sure that people understand this is very, very common. And sure, a consultant can help refine a translation, but at the end of the day, shouldn't our efforts be mainly focused on helping these resources get into the languages of wider communication so that the translators can access those resources instead of having the consultant act as an interpreter between them and those resources? Is that the best model that we should be following and promoting and proliferating? Or should we simply be seeking to help get these translators the access that they need to these resources and free these resources up so that they're able to be translated, etc.? Now, another thing that I've been trying to get people to think about for years now, maybe almost a decade, is this. I don't think this is such a shot in the dark, crazy idea, but basically the idea is that different people have different strengths and weaknesses, including consultants. And there is no consultant who can be an expert in everything. So a consultant may be particularly good at Hebrew. Another may be particularly good at Greek. And that's just because of how their lives have panned out. And most people do not have the luxury nor the intelligence to be an expert in both of those languages at the same level, especially at the same level as somebody who has dedicated their whole life to simply being good at Hebrew. And I was reminded of this as I worked with this consultant in training. He's bringing skills to the table that are wonderful, and some of them are more advanced than mine in certain areas. And I recognized this very, very early on when I was in Cameroon as a consultant in training, that this was something that could be revolutionary if we actually understood consulting like the body of Christ, where not everyone is an eye and not everyone is a mouth, not everyone is a hand, but we work together to pool our different skills. So what that would mean is that consultants in training could focus on a very specific aspect. It could be as specific as you want. Let's say this consultant only is going to focus on and become an expert in Hebrew poetry. So when a team comes to the Psalms, that consultant works with them. But when the team has to translate Matthew, it's a little bit unreasonable in my mind to have that same consultant be required to have all the knowledge and expertise necessary to also help them with Matthew. Or you could have a consultant that is only going to study and be the best of the best at a certain book of the Bible. So that could be the book of James. They know the Greek in and out. They've checked it with so many people before, so many teams, that now they have a refined sense of all the caveats, all of the stumbling blocks that they might encounter. They have incredible eagle eyes and an ability to anticipate all of these sorts of things that they need to make that translation of James for each team the best translation they could ever produce. I don't honestly think this sounds that crazy, but as I have talked about it to consultants over the last decade and leaders, no one has thought it was even interesting. And I've never heard anyone else allude to this idea in all of the discussions at the BT conferences and such. Maybe I've just missed those talks. Please let me know if there are other people talking about this, but so far, I would like to throw it out there again so that more people are thinking about this. You know, this is how it works with the rest of the world. In the rest of the world, people have these really specific skill sets that they hone and polish and develop over their lifetime to be able to produce something that is so good that nobody can ignore it, absolutely at the top of their game possible. And this happens in seminaries, for example. We don't see a professor teach a class year after year on Romans and then say, no, you can't teach on Romans anymore. We want you to teach on Deuteronomy. You're not even an Old Testament scholar, and you probably forgot the Hebrew alphabet from when you were in seminary, but now you have to teach Deuteronomy, thank you, because you have a PhD, you know? So treating a PhD as if it were a blanket expertise in all matters, let's just say all matters of theology or all matters of biblical study, isn't that a lot like saying, well, he's a consultant, so he automatically should be able to check the entire Bible with perfect accuracy and anticipate all of these complex issues and be able to navigate all of these different things and juggle these different genres? And of course, I suppose people will just respond by saying, well, it's because we're in a crisis. The consultant bottleneck is too severe, and so we don't have enough consultants to go around, so they have to wear all the hats. You know, each consultant has to be able to do everything. And my response to that is, if you didn't make it so difficult to become a consultant due to the fact that you're requiring people to be able to do everything to become a consultant, then you would be able to have more consultants, right? So if somebody is considering becoming a consultant and they're presented with, well, you have to be able to do everything and you have to spend this much time to be able to learn how to do everything and be an expert on every issue, well, that will be discouraging to a lot of people. But if you say, okay, what would you like to be an expert in? And you focus on that one thing, or maybe you already have in your life. Maybe you've already written a commentary on the book of Romans. So what are the little things do you need to be the consultant for Romans when people need it? And we can quickly get you to that place so that we have more consultants and they're doing what they're loving to do and they're doing what they're best at. Does that make sense? I hope it does. I don't know if anyone else is talking about this. I hope they are. I really sincerely hope they are. But just in case that they aren't, I just want to make sure this is on people's radar. I think this would be a breakthrough for the Bible translation movement. I really do. Because once again, I realize my own limitations constantly. But if I had, for instance, if we're working off of this model, books could go through multiple checking passes. And what that means is that, well, first of all, let me just say that consultants are just like ancient scribes. And I've said this many times. Scribes are human. They get tired. They get distracted. All of these things compete with their ability to provide a perfect check of scripture. And they have a limited amount of time to be able to go do multiple passes of a book to check if they missed something the first time around because of those human failings, those human distractions or whatever else. And so if we have people with different skill levels, different personalities doing multiple passes on books, then that ensures an even greater level of accuracy. Because obviously a different set of eyes is going to nail different things, is going to pick out different things that you missed. It doesn't matter how amazing you are, what a brilliant genius you are. It doesn't matter. You are going to miss things as a consultant. So if we have the combination of superiorly trained mother tongue translators who aren't relying so much on a consultant, right? Because the tendency, like I've talked about in the past, is to get lazy because, oh, the consultant will clean it up. The consultant will find the problem. The consultant will solve this so we don't have to do the research on it. So we don't have to look it up in the lexicon, which is a pain. All of that kind of thing happens. So let's say they're not presented with that kind of assurity that the consultant is going to solve everything for them. And they're trained to the highest level possible. You know, there's people on the team with access to the biblical languages, all of that, right? They have good resources. And then you combine that with people who have these really, really fine-tuned expertises in a book of the Bible, or it could even just be this person is an expert at all the difficult key terms in this certain range of books. Let's say the Pentateuch. All those difficult key terms that are presented there for the first time, this person has become an expert in dealing with ways, creative ways to find glosses for those, to find explanatory footnotes for those, all of those things, right? And that's what they do over and over and over. And they've boiled that down to a science. And then, of course, we can't forget textual criticism, can we, right? And that's one of the things that ends up being one of the advanced notes that I didn't even mention, right? Often, because we fail to train teams in advanced textual criticism, it ends up being the consultant's job to tell them, well, just go with this version, right? They end up asking you, well, we've looked at this issue. It's really hard for us to understand why this difference is here, or we maybe understand why this difference between the manuscripts is here, but just tell us the right answer, right? Just tell us what to go with. And often that answer is, right, go with the legacy translation and the language of wider communication, and that'll be fine. But let's just say textual criticism is your expertise. Maybe it's for the whole Hebrew Bible. Maybe it's for just a certain book, right? Because there are so many different textual variants that these take so much time to wrap your mind around that it would be so helpful if we had one person who's just the expert on 2 Chronicles, textual variants for 1 and 2 Chronicles, let's say. And then he does another pass. You know, he notices things that you may not have noticed in the process of working with the team on the text critical issues. Because let's face it, a consultant is trying to check so many different things at once that he's inevitably going to fail. But if you have somebody going through a book and their only objective and purpose is to focus on one thing and doing it really well, wow, there's so much more potential. And I think also so much more joy that could be had in the process, because you're not feeling overwhelmed trying to juggle so many things at once. Maybe we could compare it to a parent who's trying to keep track of like 7 different kids all at once. You know, they're all doing different things. They've all got different needs. They're all going a little crazy. And you're trying to attend to everyone. And somebody got hurt over here. And then somebody needs some water and all of this stuff. And that's just not that enjoyable. But if you have the ability to focus on one kid at a time and not have to control everything at once. And maybe you have some help, right? You have one adult for each kid. They're able to focus and play with them, help them. That's a different story. Then it becomes a lot of fun. It becomes really enjoyable. And so that's what I would love to see us move towards in Bible translation more and more. And maybe we don't call those people consultants. So they don't have this kind of exalted position that they have to solve everything. And so the team doesn't look at them with this kind of superhuman status and think, oh, they're going to solve all of our problems for us. We can do less work. We can do less careful work because they're going to pick up the pieces. Anyway, I hope that has been helpful. And if you're a consultant and this resonates with you, please reach out to me and let me know. And if you want to come on the podcast sometime and talk a little bit more about these sorts of things that I addressed in this episode and maybe give some examples from your own consulting, I'd be open to that. Please reach out to me. So the more fresh voices we can hear, the more kinds of different experiences we can hear from, the better, the more we all learn from each other.